Hey there, and welcome to episode number 30 of Become a Guitarist Today with myself, Adam Roach. In this episode, I talk to Thomas McLaughlin, otherwise known as Thomas McLaughlin. Now, if you haven't heard of Thomas yet, then stop this podcast now and click on the links in my notes below to hear his unbelievable playing at such a young age. One of the clips is him performing in Steve Vai's video clip for the audiences listening. There's another clip of his band Bad for Good, and the other one is on a comedy show from the UK called Little and Large. Now, in the interview, we also talk about how he opened up for Ozzy Osbourne at the age of only 7, and how he first met Steve Vai in 1988, and how he was and still is actually one of the youngest artists to sign with Interscope Records, as well as his band Bad for Good. And you'll be amazed the amount of practice he did as a young kid. Now, also throughout this podcast, you'll hear parts of Thomas's album 91 to 95, which also I've put the link in the notes. So if you do want to download it, check it out. Amazing album for his playing at that age. Yeah, it's incredible. Now, before we get into the interview, just have a couple of little announcements to make. Now, first of all, my book, Become a Guitarist Today, has been picked up by ANSCA Examination Board, and two of my songs are actually in the syllabus now for preliminary and grade one modern guitar. So anyone interested in doing guitar exams, you can now use two of my pieces, and actually some of the other songs as well you can use for the free choice. And for the people who are on my closed Facebook group, you notice I have changed the name now. It's now called Guitar Lessons with Adam Roach. So I have the two separate pages. So I have the Guitar Lessons page and also the one that's open to the public, which is called Become a Guitarist Today Facebook page. So let's go over now to the interview with Thomas, where I ask him how old he was when he first started playing guitar.
I started playing guitar really young, when I was 4. How that came about was my dad was he was into guitar music, I'd say, more than actual playing, although he could play a little bit. He wasn't kind of virtuoso, but you know, he was into rock, classic rock, you know, Led Zeppelin, Thin Lizzy. So he was kind of into guitar enough that he would have a guitar in the house. When he'd go to work and he'd kind of be out of the house, I used to go and sort of drag this guitar out, and it was ironically my first guitar. Was an Ibanez, you know, the first guitar that I played anyway. And it was an old Ibanez artist. And I kind of, you know, I knew he'd kind of always stalk behind the TV. I'd drag it out and he'd find it laying on the floor. And, you know, a couple of weeks later, I think he was asking my mum, you know, why is my guitar was out? And kind of saw that I had an interest in it. And then he showed me my first couple of chords. And I remember it was like, you know, just like, bar chords, power chords. But it was the chord change and the boys are back in town by Thin Lizzy. I think, you know, even back then you have that moment where you get the timing right or something right for the first time and it just clicks. It's like, ah. Yeah. So I got me started, you know, and so I'm very lucky that he kind of had a guitar in the house in the first place, really.
Yeah, and how did you go with the reach? I mean, being 4 years old, like, it would have been pretty big.
Yeah, it was big. Yeah, I mean, I think we actually have a picture on the back of my first instrumental record, 91 and 95, and I hadn't seen it until recently. I found a box of CDs, and in fact, here we go.
Oh, there we
so
go.
that is the Ibanez artist, and I'm probably about 5 there, I guess.
Oh wow, well, it doesn't look too big.
Exactly. So I seem to be taking it well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I never really started on like quarter size, that'd be small, half size and three quarters and stuff, you know. I was kind of like straight to the full size. I didn't seem to have a kind of reach. I don't reach issue. I mean, I don't have, you know, Paul Gilbert style massive hands or Steve Vai massive hands, but they've got some good reach on them, fortunately.
Yeah. So do you remember, like, I know you said Boys Are Back in Town. Was there any other songs you remember learning at the start?
Yeah, I mean, back then, after the sort of Thin Lizzy and classic rock, I quickly discovered that, you know, with my dad, I really loved the Aussie tracks, Ozzy Osbourne, and I loved Randy Rhoads' guitar playing. So as much as I could, I mean, you know, it's difficult for a 5 and a 6 year old to kind of learn Aussie tracks.
Yeah.
But if I could kind of get close with some riffs and stuff, and, you know, by the time I was 6 and 7, tracks like Crazy Train was a sort of favorite, you know, that would kind of mash up, you know, because my thing when I was a very young boy, you know, like 7 and stuff and 7 years old playing in pubs and social clubs and all these places that kids probably shouldn't really be. I would kind of do like, you know, an explosion of 10, 15 minutes of solos and then mix in, you know, the kind of riffs from maybe, you know, Crazy Train and Ain't Talking About Love by, you know, Eddie and, you know, all these kind of things that I loved, you know. But, yeah, I love the early David Lee Roth stuff. Randy Rhoads, love that. That guy was an awesome player. And massive, obviously, Eddie fan as well, you know. I mean, who doesn't like Van Halen, you know?
That's right.
Awesome. In fact, you know, my dad, I don't know if he saw that video, but one of my things was when my dad took me from the hospital, I think he had it in his mind, the first thing I want Thomas to listen to was the first Eddie Van Halen track, album.
Mm.
And he apparently played it in the car on the way home when he brought me from the hospital. So, so he planted the seeds early, I guess.
Yeah. Do you remember what age you were when you got onto the bar chords and things like that?
It seemed to go really quickly. You know, I found some footage recently where I was like 7, maybe 6, 7, and already, you know, I was kind of like shredding a lot and fluently moving around the neck and stuff and playing. You know, obviously it's quite wild, and you know, as a young kid at that age is going to be. But you could see, you know, just looking back, it's like, obviously there's no video or audio from when I was like 4 or 5. Yeah. But when you see stuff like from like a 7 year old and, you know, from the TV footage, when I start, you know, getting sort of notice and stuff, you know, you could see the sort of stuff coming together rapidly. And then by the time I was 8, it was like massive, more amount of control and dexterity on the sort of fingerboard and stuff. So, you know, I mean, I didn't really think about it too much, you know, obviously personally, because, you know, I would just be playing all the time. But all these years later, when I found that footage and you can kind of see, right, this is, you know, roughly what I was doing when I was 7 and roughly what I was doing when I was 8. Mm. You know, you can kind of see the massive incline continuously. But, I mean, I used to play even as a young boy, you know, like 7, 8, 9, 10 hours a day, no problem.
Wow.
and a little bit later, you know, I never really got on well with school and stuff. My dad would drop me off at school, and by the time he'd get back home, you know, I'd be already out the back of the door of the school and be back home and playing my guitar. So, you know, he kind of got teachers to come round, and even as a young kid, before Bad for Good and the sort of Steve Vai sort of stuff, you know, I had the mentality I would be putting in the hours at least into the guitar that I would be doing going to school. So it's like, I kind of knew, you know, I definitely want to go hard on this and put a lot of time into it. And, you know, I think if you love playing, you love playing. The hours just kind of take care of themselves when you're sitting playing and enjoying it, you know, that much.
That's unreal. If only all my students were like that, I'd be very happy.
Oh yeah, I know that feeling, man. Yeah.
So you,
I went through a
well?
Period of like, yeah, I used to teach, you know, a lot, maybe on a weekend, you know, when I'd come back to the UK and stuff, and I had, you know, some regular students, and some were great and put in the time, and some just like to come around and play with all my Ibanezes.
Yeah,
that'll work as well, you know.
Yeah, which actually probably goes into the next question I was going to ask you about with the practicing. I mean, yep, all those hours, but for like the kids now, you know, they've always got distractions, you know, their iPads or TV, whatever else.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
So I guess you didn't watch much TV at the time? Just guitar?
Very little. I mean, you know, I think back then, there definitely wasn't the distractions that is around today. Yeah. You know, like you say, you know, the tablets and that's a lot of that stuff. I mean, you know, the tablet's just the start of it, and then you hit, you know, YouTube and YouTube Kids, and it's this kind of endless pulling you in for more and more. You know, back in my day, I think at like school time, between 4 and 5 on one channel, you'd probably get some kids stuff, you know. And now it's like cable TV with hundreds of channels of that stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think a lot of that stuff guys today can use to their advantage, you know. So the flip side of all of that is, you know, if you're on YouTube and you're really into guitar playing, if you're really into it, you probably, you know, you're going to commit somewhat and do it. And, you know, back when I was growing up, the best you could get was some like Hot Licks VHS. And it's like, you know, guys shredding in spandex and it looked great. But realistically, it's like it was more entertaining to watch than educational. So now, obviously, you know, there's some great content on YouTube. And I took so many years away from playing, and I wanted to kind of come back with a different sound. And something, you know, and kind of, I always knew I phrased things slightly different in my playing. When I was away from the guitar for a long time, I was producing a lot of electronic music, and I was really kind of into breakbeat and hip hop and, you know, a lot of all that kind of different genres, very non-guitar based stuff. And I wanted a lot of that kind of influence to come through my playing. So it's like what the YouTube stuff, sort of stuff allowed me to do is to identify, right, I know I'm kind of doing something in my picking, but I kind of look on YouTube and, oh, okay, I'm doing this slant picking stuff. And it's not that you kind of go and kind of copy what's happening on YouTube, but I think it gives you the tool to identify what you're doing. And with me, enabled me to say, right, okay, that is what I've been doing, and we can work on that and emphasize that and come out with interesting stuff on it. So although the dangers for young kids is like distractions on, you know, social stuff and YouTube, they're there to be used wisely and you know, to promote yourself on all the social platforms and to learn as well. So yes. It's catch 22.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And also there is like a lot of apps too on the iPads and everything now for the guitar. Have you heard of Musician? It's called Musician.
So I haven't heard of that one.
That's right. Really, really good. It's basically like a syllabus, you know, starting from level 0 to level 10.
Okay.
And so it picks up the sound of the guitar and you go through the songs. Yeah, it's really good for teaching. It's been great. And yeah, the kids get a score, so the better their timing, the more score they get.
Right. So that's going to make them a little bit more competitive and want to...
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Good idea.
Yeah, so you had your friends on and say, "Hey, I beat you this week." Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
But yeah, it's funny going back to what you said about the VHS tapes, you know, watching the people playing long hair and the spandex. Like, if you saw that today, yeah, you'd be questioning what's going on here.
Yeah, definitely. Unless you're from that era, and then I think you'd appreciate it. Fun times, you know. It's like, and also you couldn't really pause it as well, because every time you pause a VHS, a lot of the time it's like shaking violently. So you end up, you know, probably taking a fit if you pause it for too long.
Yeah.
But, no, very cool. But I think it did force you, you know, to kind of use your ears and imagination. You know, I cannot imagine, like, you know, when the early Van Halen stuff came on the scene, you know, people must have been like at the time, like thinking, what the hell is this? You know, it sounds great, but how is it happening? You know, because, you know, you couldn't just load up YouTube and watch a guy shred that sort of style, you know? So I think that added to it, you know. I remember like, the thing me and my dad would do a lot would just play like the early David Lee Roth stuff, you know, like Edam and Smile and Skyscraper and all the early Van Halen stuff and Aussie stuff. And we'd just drive and listen to that stuff. And sometimes, you know, you don't need to know how it's done, but it just sounds very cool, you know? So
yeah. So going back to your when you were playing that 7 hours a day or whatever it was, so what would you do in that time? Was it like just learning new songs or playing with your dad?
It went through different stages. In my area at the time, there wasn't really the resources for like teachers. So, you know, obviously my dad spotted something and, you know, he quickly, you know, okay, I like this type of guitar. And we had, you know, Hamers and BC Riches. And then, of course, I saw like the David Lee Roth stuff with Vi and the Gem. And then we ordered the Gem. And then from a playing point of view, a lot of the electric guitar playing and the shredding sort of stuff was all really self-taught. You know, obviously when you learn keys a little bit and you learn songs, you kind of make that connection and link. And a really cool thing that my dad did really early on, and I think it's even to this day, it's like embedded, is he didn't really know theory, but with a pen and paper, and he basically drew a neck, a guitar neck, and he found out all the sharps and flats in every key. And he basically write out every note on every string until the graph essentially was full. And then we'd sit for like an hour or two until I was bored or had enough, and we'd go through all those kind of positions. And even though he wasn't like that type of guitar player, he could watch my fingers and go, ah, that's not right. That's not right. So that just like instantly after a couple of months of that, it just in every key, it's like I could be comfortable playing over the neck, so you don't get really stuck in like, you know, this position and then an octave higher and all this cool stuff in between, you know, which sometimes people struggle with. Obviously, you know, not everybody, but it's really very useful to be able to phrase things in a certain way, and you need to be in certain positions for that happen, you know. And you know, the tone between the E and the B string in different position is massive, and then the, you know, and so on to the G string. So and then so that was really cool, and you know, like I say, that kind of stuck with me for a very long time, and even to date. But then I he found this really cool classical teacher, and I started taking classical lessons as well, and we did some songs and some reading and did all that sort of stuff. But he knew, obviously, the type of stuff I was into. So we learned a lot of scales. And the cool thing is a lot of the scales we're learning was everything as much as possible was done in three octaves. So it was like kind of going from essentially one end of the neck right up to the other one. And again, it's kind of adding this comfortable going all over the neck sort of thing. And another kind of quirky, cool thing that stuck with me, because I really enjoy playing the classical stuff. Classical, pretty much the default minor is harmonic minor. And so very much even till today, I my default key, if I'm in B, I'll have the harmonic minor thing going on. But my thing is, I never want it to sound like it's harmonic minor. So it's always blended with a mixture of chromatics and dancing in and out of the notes and phrasing things in a way that's kind of unique sounding or yeah, my sort of style, you know? So I think just putting those together, you know, the fact that you can get comfortable all over the neck and your default key is a little bit different to somebody else's. And I enjoy kind of putting a lot of sort of chromatic kind of quirky stuff in there. I think you end up, you know, sort of sounding a little different, and it helps you sort of stand out a little bit.
That's great.
Yeah. So yeah, classical definitely helped a lot. My dad kind of just going off his own back to draw those graphs was very cool. And you know, later on when I start going to the States and stuff, I'm studying a book by Ted Green called Chemistry. That book, I don't know if you saw that book, but it's a pretty intense book. And each page, I mean, the font size is like 4 if you had the equivalent on a computer. It's tiny, but it's like 80 chords or something like that per page. It's just, on first glance, it's really intense. But, you know, I'd go to bed kind of looking at that as a kid, you know, kind of putting himself to sleep in a bedtime story. It'd be like reading these chords in Ted Green's books. Wow. But later on, I got a chance to kind of take a couple of lessons with Ted in LA, and amazing experience. You know, he was an amazing guy, and such a character, you know. He's like, his house is just completely filled with books. You could barely get through the walkway into the, you know, into the living room. And then you eventually get into the living room, and there's no furniture. It's just like a Telecaster on the floor, his giant, you know, 4-liter bottle of Coke. And you just sit on the floor and no amps, play. And it's like, you kind of feel each other out. And then I think he kind of, you know, we played some stuff and invite me back for some more lessons. I think it's very much, you know, with him, it was great. You know, such an experience, but, you know, to have spent so many nights kind of reading the books and then eventually get to sort of sit down and be with that guy. Very, very cool. Enjoyed that.
Classical guitar?
Classical really was probably between 8 and 11, 9 and 11.
Yep.
Yeah, by the time I kind of went to LA and did the Band for Good thing, I'd stopped kind of taking classical lessons, but I've had, by that time, enough years to kind of get a good idea, you know, about it. And obviously, I didn't really go the classical route because I was an electric guitar player ultimately, but it left enough impression on me that, you know, it stuck with me.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. I did classical as well, you know, later though, when I was about maybe 14 to 18 or something. You know, through school I had to do it for the exams. Uh-huh. And then, you know, when I saw that, the Vi-Jewel, you know, on Crossroads, with all the arpeggios and everything.
Oh, yeah, legendary.
That was great, seeing that.
Yeah, you know, I had this store around the corner from me, and it was literally, you know, like, 50 yards. It was like the corner shop around the corner from me, but they had VHSs at the time, and I rented that movie so many times from that store. After about, I don't know, 6 months of renting it, I went to return it back, and they're like, no, just keep it.
Oh, really?
And I watched it like at least twice a week, you know. It was like such an awesome movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, love that movie.
Yeah, I still watch it.
Obviously, the end jewel.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it in many, many years, you know. It's like I'm almost scared to watch it because I've watched it so much.
Yeah.
I should maybe revisit it, but yeah, it's like I don't want to put it on and be disappointed. But yeah, I'm sure I won't be. Yeah.
Did you ever learn the whole jewel?
I didn't, you know, the stuff, how it starts off, and you know, some of it. But I didn't really sit down. You know, I know some people like working out note for note and lick for lick, and you know, I didn't do that. But Steve used to play really different back then. You know, it's like his picking was like extremely different than to what he is now. Obviously, you know, people change over the years, and you know, progress and move in different directions. But yeah, his picking game was like really on point there, you know. It's like very, very cool.
Mm. Now, just going back a little bit, so I found an old video of yours online. You're on some a UK show, like a comedy show, I think. Was it Purple Haze?
Oh, okay, yeah, right. That'll be like the Little and Large show, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know how old you were on that one?
It was about 8, yeah. Okay. So that would be like around the time that I kind of met Steve. And all those kind of TV shows and appearances, it started off in my local town. You know, the news teams would come out from all the different channels.
Yep.
And then that led to doing some national TV stuff, and then also on kids' TV shows, and then shows like Little and Large, you know, where, you know, obviously it's like quite funny and entertaining. But that's like quite a famous British classic sort of TV show.
Okay.
You know, prime time. But I saw that also recently, and I hadn't seen it for like, I don't remember seeing it, you know, in the past.
Yeah.
But quite funny though, you know. And I think I've got the floral gem, and it must have been not long after I got that kind of floral gem as well.
Yeah. So when you do shows like that, and you know, they're going to that little bit of jam where you're just soloing. Was that actually improvising, or did you have that worked out?
No, it's as much as possible, anything like that. You know, I love improvising, and, you know, I definitely consider myself like almost a high risk player, because a lot of stuff I'll go for. I'd rather go for stuff than play it safe and have something cool happen, a happy accident. So I'm one of those guys that I'll take the risk, and I'll, you know, obviously back then it was all improvised, and, you know, a lot of the time when I would open up for Ozzy Osbourne when I was like 7 or something, it was like, okay, here you go, you're on stage and play for 20 minutes. And you're obviously throwing some of your classic tracks that you maybe has learned, but the rest of the 16 minutes, it's like playing and improvising and, you know, just kind of really going for it. So I really enjoy improvising, and I love kind of, although I don't have the chance a lot these days to jam with people, but, you know, now that I'm kind of back out and doing this stuff, I'm sure more opportunities will come up where I'll be jamming with people and bouncing off each other. And, you know, it's like, yeah, I really enjoy that side of things. And for me, it's like I was saying before, I'd rather really go for it and find some really cool stuff than hang back. And, you know, if the byproduct of that is you're going to make some mistakes, or, you know, hit something that you're not happy with, you know, you can't take it too seriously. You know, you got to enjoy it. And definitely got to have some fun, and, you know, don't be too upset over a few bum notes now and again.
Oh, for sure. That's right. Yeah. So for that age, though, like, to improvise like that, you don't see that very often at all.
Yeah, I guess not. You know, it's probably how it all kind of started, I guess, you know?
Yeah, that's probably I was going to say, that's probably a big, you know, like a point that I saw in your playing, like looking back at those videos. Because, you know, you do see some young kids playing, you know, it's all maybe sight reading or just playing what people show them. But you could tell you're having fun with it, you're jamming, you're playing like like a 20-year-old.
Oh, no, that's cool. You know, it's like not long after that, when I first met Steve backstage of Donington, 88, you know, I remember that kind of sitting in this touring bus and playing Tobacco Road, you know, Tobacco Road, the classic kind of David Roth that they did the cover of. And then Tobacco Road immediately was followed by some wailing and shred and stuff, and the rest was history. But yeah, definitely, you know, for me, that's what I like to do. And, you know, I recommend obviously having structures and song arrangements and stuff, but don't be afraid to chuck in some oddballs, you know, to kind of spice it up, you know.
That's right. So now with that whole via connection, so you're in the back of your car, is that right? Just playing away?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these things, you know, it was quite by chance, really. It was just, you know, if you bear in mind, in that time period, there was no internet. You couldn't email people, or my dad couldn't email people and say, all right, but let's hook this up. And, you know, it was like, in terms of getting backstage at Donington, it's like, right, we've got this kid and he's dressed head to toe in leathers. He's got this Ibanez gem. He's here to see Steve. And, you know, it was like almost by chance, you know, a lot of these situations. And likewise, when I opened for Ozzy, it's like my dad would take me to these venues and bang, you'd see this kid, you know, head to toe in leathers, looking like a little wild man with a with this crazy axe and stuff, you know. And you get that in and do the playing, and then the two and two together, and it's sunny. It's like, it's a different situation. But so I met Steve like at Monsters of Rock in 88, and again, it was just played in the back of my dad's car, a state car with a sort of the backup. And I think one of his guys spotted me and invited me back to the tour bus, played some stuff, and the rest is history.
Well, that's incredible. You don't see that these days.
Well, yeah, so we obviously kept in contact after that, and that led to me later doing the audience's listening video for his Passion and Warfare album, which was really cool. That was shot in Florida in an actual school, and it's like to suddenly be in the camera in an acting situation.
Yeah, that's right.
That was fun, you know. So it was a good shoot, and a lot of fun memories from that. And especially when they blew up that clock thing behind me and didn't tell me they were going to blow it up. So it's like a genuine reaction of jumping out of my leathers, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Yeah. So after that, Vi took you over to the States. That's how that happened?
Yeah. I mean, I'd already been going to the States to do things like the NAMM show.
Oh, okay. And
yeah, so, you know, how all that led up to, you know, Bad for Good, for example, is, you know, Vi doing playing at NAMM show, and, you know, I got kind of involved with Brands and Ibanez and some other guys. And ultimately, it kind of led to a record deal with Interscope Records, yeah. As their youngest artist to be signed to them. I think that still is the case. And so I signed up with Interscope, and we kind of knew it was like time to do a band thing, you know, rather than, you know, shredding, you know. Yeah, it's yeah. You can still have shred stuff, but, you know, you need tracks in a band. So Band for Good was put together, and you know, in the order of the members of that band, my dad had saw a guy watch me play at Ibanez. The kid turned out to be Brooks Wackerman, who's obviously, you know, from the Wackerman family. The whole family are just like obscenely talented musicians, you know, just unbelievable. So my dad found out he was a drummer, and he was interested in playing with me. So he was like the first guy in Band for Good. And then a lot of the time, you know, when you're in Hollywood, it's like, you know, we'd have rehearsals and playing and stuff, and my dad would just kind of walk up and down Hollywood Boulevard. And of course, at that time, the GIT thing was like huge. It was still kind of booming. And you know, I think my dad just kind of stuck his nose in there and saw Zach Young, the bass player's kind of details was up on a board or something like that. So again, it's just like, it could have been anybody on there, you know. And and Saxon, you know, incredible bass player and a fantastic guy. So he was like the third guy in. And then we came back to the UK, and I think maybe it was Tony Ferguson that discovered Danny Cooksey was the fourth member. He was the vocalist and the singer, and great guy and incredible voice. And that was the band complete. And then Steve, you know, was obviously, you know, I'd done the audience's listening, and we kind of, you know, when he was over here, I'd go see him at David Lee Roth shows. So Interscope kind of saw the connection. Steve came in to kind of produce the band and write a lot of the tracks. So yeah, it was tapes sent over of all the sort of early tracks, and I had some ideas and stuff and some tracks. So when you hear things like Felony and Tire Kick in some of the tracks on Bad for Good's album, those are the kind of tracks that I wrote. And then we obviously went over to LA, rehearsed it for a while, and recorded it at the Mothership at Steve's place. And that's where I sort of stayed with Steve for a long time, and had a lot of fun hanging out and doing crazy stuff. And my favorite thing, or, you know, was just after we'd finished recording, was going up to the vault. I mean, there was just some awesome guitars in, you know. And obviously, like I say, it's like the David Lee Roth videos, the heart shaped guitar, the the green gems, all that stuff was in his vault, you know. So I'd go and spend a few hours, you know, every other night, just kind of playing with all that stuff and pulling out all these classic legacy guitars. So a lot of fun.
Like a little kid in a toy shop.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
So do you still see the guys from Back for Good?
Yeah, I mean, I saw Zach got married not so long ago, and I went over to LA for the wedding, and so we got a chance to hang out, and Brooks was there, and Brooks is in Avenged Sevenfold now, so he played in my hometown like not so long ago. So yeah, I've got to go see the show and hang out and meet the guys, and that was a lot of fun. Yeah, and obviously he's doing an incredible job in that band. You know, his drum is just like blazing. You know, and it's really cool to hear. You know, the background. You know, that the whole family has with drums. And you can tell when you listen to the stage, the album, it's like he's contributing a huge amount to the overall sound and the feel of the tracks, you know. He's absolutely just blazing, you know. So incredible drummer.
Yeah.
And but Avenged's great anyway, but he's really kinda putting his really nice sort of stamp on it.
So how many albums did you do with Back for Good?
Just the one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's so Refugee is the one, and then we start writing a lot of the other stuff, and you know, it's like getting deeper into sort of, you know we'd come out of touring with Joe Satriani, and it was a lot of time on the road. I mean, it's like it was quite a, you know, for a 12-13 year old kid, you know, it was a big tour, and it was a hell of a lot of fun, but you start to discover what it's like to be normal and do kind of normal stuff, you know. So it kind of got to the point where I do like 5-6 months in LA, and I come back home and see my friends for like a week or two, and then it started to turn a little bit in terms of playing and touring and doing all that stuff. It almost become like not fun, and obviously the kind of hanging out with my friends and doing regular stuff, you know, was you know, a lot more fun. So I think as soon as that starts to happen, it's only a matter of time before you kind of back away from it, you know.
Yeah. And then I just noticed on Apple Music, so you got the album there. Was it the one album you had on there? Is it like 91 to 95?
Yeah.
So what's that one?
That is so after that, after I kind of left the band for good, I came back to the UK. And, you know, I had all these kind of riffs and licks and stuff and, you know, ideas. And really my dad wanted to kind of document a sort of time capsule of my playing, you know, through that period. Hence the 91-95 album. So, yeah, it's an instrumental record. And it's got a lot of styles in it. It's like, obviously it's a lot of, you know, distorted, you know, solos and tracks and stuff on there, but there's quite a lot of sort of really kind of clean stuff on there as well, which is like the sort of funk stuff I started getting into. Because on the back end of Bad for Good, I was starting to, you know, listen to a lot of rap and a lot of hip-hop, and I wasn't really listening to any guitar stuff. And so by the time I kind of decided, yeah, I'm gonna kind of come back to the UK and maybe do this album and start doing other stuff, guitar kind of music was just really already at that point not really my thing, you know. I was kind of, you know, really getting into other side of things and electronic music and all the different sort of genres like drum and bass and breakbeat and stuff, you know. When we made the Band for Good record and just being around the studio a lot, I was like, that side of things was really super interesting, you know, just seeing the tracks go from very sort of, you know, rough sketches to complete sort of tracks, and the transition and what's involved and doing that, you know, that was really super interesting. I got to kind of sit on a lot of really cool sessions with some, you know, guys like Jimmy Iovine and stuff, and some really very cool engineers. And you know, I kind of was always quizzing Steve about, you know, how to operate the console, and, you know, he explained how the bus system worked and how to patch in all the outboard gear and stuff, you know, because obviously Steve was kind of mixing a lot of that stuff in-house, you know, at the mothership, and I was there. So by the time I kind of left that stuff and came back to the UK and did this instrumental record, and then got my first A-track and my first sequencer and first sampler. And when I got my Archive sampler, that was it, you know. It was like a new kind of thing had really taken over, and you know, I've got a very obsessive personality. It's like if I'm into something, it's like that is it. It's like 100% in that direction, you know. And you know, obviously that helps with things like playing, because when you're playing, you become obsessive about it, and you kind of keep raising your own bar and pushing forward. But yeah, so I got really into the electronic side of things, and later on that led to producing music for other artists under a different name. The McRockland name is, you know, it's suddenly stopped, and that was at a time where the internet was in its infancy, and it was very easy to kind of just drop off the ladder, and you weren't really kind of easily to be sort of queried, where's he going, you know. It was like it, you know, that stuff came later. So yeah, really got into kind of production and mixing, and later that led to mastering for kind of the last 6 years, and all that stuff's become super useful now for the new EP, because, you know, I kind of had a certain sound that I wanted for it, and to have the convenience of recording, mixing, and even to the mastering stage at home without the pressures of the being on the clock in a studio, it was like, it's been super useful, and it's allow us to kind of explore, you know, kind of different mix options and stuff, and have that freedom and flexibility. So so all that stuff eventually become very useful.
So when's the album or the EP coming out?
Yeah, the EP's done. It's completed. It's finished. So just waiting on like some very small bits and the final artwork. But it's like, it's so frustrating sitting on music that you spend so much time, you know, maybe writing, and then, you know, the detail of recording and mixing it, and you just want to put it out there for people to check out. But it's almost there. I mean, the music is done, so it's just the other stuff now. So hopefully we'll be able to get that finished very soon and get it out there. But yeah, I'm excited, you know. I mean, I've been putting some little sort of teaser videos on Instagram, and some playthroughs and certain sections on Instagram and Facebook and stuff. And yeah, the feedback's been really cool, so I'm excited for people to hear the actual full finished version of it.
Yeah, can't wait. Now, the other thing is, I noticed in the interview with Eric, I think you only just started using the Fractal Audio. So you've been using that for a while now? You're still using
it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Fractal Axe Effect is Axe Effects is used entirely on every track, and it just works for me. I mean, I've used a lot of different modelers, and there's some great options these days, you know, whether it's the Line 6 Helix, the Kemper stuff's really cool. But the Fractal overall is one of those units where straight away it had the right amp feel, and with modelers it's very difficult to get that balance between it sounding great but also feeling really good. And when I tried other amp modelers, as good as they were, I always either had to tweak them a lot or use third party effects, you know. So for example, I was using a lot of Strymon and stuff with the Helix, and my thing was, I want to use modelers because I want the convenience of having one box or as little boxes as possible, and have being able to recreate the EP sounds, for example, in a live situation. It's like huge. So some of them, you know, the amps were really great, but I didn't really like the reverbs or delays. So the Strymon stuff came in, and some other stuff, and MXR do some amazing reverbs as well. But the Fractal, just in one product, from amps through to the DSP side of things, it's just amazing. You know, so really, really, really happy with that. And there's a lot of different types of amps on the EP as well. You know, there's tracks which are really mellow Marshall Plexi sort of sounds, and there's not a lot of gain. And then some tracks, they've kind of got that sort of PV5150, really kind of punchy sort of vibe. And then there's a lot of cleans on there as well. and each amp that we were kind of, that I was going for, I couldn't have kind of hoped for better, you know, from the sound. And you know, it would always be nice to have like 20 amazing amps mic'd up at one point of time, and but that's not normally an option. And this thing gets very, very close to all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But with instant recall and everything in one box. So yeah, super happy with them. AXA is a nice unit. You know, if you're kind of jumping in and you don't need, obviously they have different products with different level of DSP and aimed at a different area, but the AXA is a really cool little unit because it's a floor unit and it's got some real-time knobs, so it's like, you know, you can tweak it quite easily.
Yeah,
but you know, it's not for everybody, and there's certainly nothing wrong with sitting with a little 5-watt tube amp.
Yeah,
and you know, for me, I think it's a good thing to sit and make a little simple, you know, something with a tone and volume only, and to make that sound good. You have to make that stuff sound good, you know. Otherwise, you know, you don't need a, you don't want a fractal, you know. It's like playing the worst amp you can, you know. It's like when I first started playing again, I sat with a really bright, awful sound, and I played, you know, with for like 6 months, a lot of exercises, a lot of sort of shredding, and you know, kind of a lot of scales. But really, it was always about kind of cleaning the fingers up, cleaning everything up, you know, and sitting very close to this amp with no effects on, a really bright, honky, awful sound, but it exposed everything.
Mm.
And then you could go back and say, right, you know, you just made working on things a lot easier. Yeah. So I think the point is, you know, you should, if you're a good player, you should just be able to plug into an amp and make it work regardless.
Yeah.
But it is nice to have all those options. My setup traditionally over the years was just like whatever I had, you know, was typically a Marshall head.
Yeah.
And the only pedal on the floor was like a Tube Screamer or a Marshall Drive Master or whatever distortion pedal was available. You know, it was just, that was it. And my clean sound was just by backing down on the volume pot and cleaning it up that way.
Yeah. That's pretty much what mine is now.
Yeah. And that is a cool thing. And, if that works for you, absolutely, it's a great thing, you know.
Yeah, these days a lot of my playing is more, you know, acoustic solo gigs or, you know, not many band gigs. So it's, but I do want to get into more recording as well. So, be interesting to hear your recording as well.
Yeah, well, yeah. Hopefully, you like the sounds of the guitar sounds on it then.
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome.
All right.
What time is it over there? It's like super early, right?
9:30 a.m.
Yeah, until I seen where you were, I was like, yeah, where the hell is it? Yeah, so okay, so
right,
yeah,
down the bottom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, have a good day, and it has been a pleasure, Adam.
Thank you, Thomas.
Anytime. Take care, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
So I hope you guys enjoyed the interview with Thomas. So really, I can't think of anyone else that I know at the age of 7 or 8 or even 6 that would practice for 6 to 10 hours a day. It's amazing, but he did it and that paid off. So don't forget to check out all those links in my notes where you can check out some of the things that he did when he was younger. Also, I'm going to link the interview that he did with Eric Broadbent, my guest from last week from EVH Gear TV. He also did a great interview with Eric and did some playing as well. So thanks again, Thomas. And hopefully we'll get Thomas back on when he releases his new album, which should be out this year. So join me next week where I interview some of the musicians' top guitar players from around the world. Find out more information about them and how they got into musician and what they're doing with their music. And don't forget, you can check out my website, becomeaguitaristtoday.com, where you can sign up for any of the packages there that are available from $2.50 up to $20. And you can also purchase my book, Become a Guitarist Today, which is now available for ANSCA exams. So until next week, keep jamming.